One, the hits.
Billboard, baby.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Susan Shand, Katie Weaver, and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Susan Shand.
Argentina's Senate passed a law legalizing abortion up to the 14th week of pregnancy Wednesday. The vote came after the Senate debated the measure for 12 hours. It is considered a victory for the women's movement that has been fighting for the measure for more than 30 years. The vote also means that abortion will be legal after the 14th week in cases of rape or if there is a danger to the mother's life. Argentina's new law might affect the legality of abortion across South America, where the operation is mostly illegal. The measure passed by a vote of 38-29. The bill had already been approved by Argentina's Chamber of Deputies, the lower house, and had the support of President Alberto Fernandez. Safe, legal, and free abortion is now the law, Fernandez wrote on Twitter after the vote. During his campaign for the presidency, Fernandez had promised to legalize abortion. "Today we are a better society that expands women's rights and guarantees public health," he added. Argentina, the former home of Pope Francis, is the largest Latin American country to legalize abortion. The operation is legal in Uruguay, Cuba, Mexico City, Mexico's Oaxaca State, the Antilles, and French Guiana. But it remains largely illegal across South America. Outside the Senate, pro- and anti-abortion activists gathered, separated by a large barrier. The bill's supporters wore the color green that represents their abortion rights movement. They waved green flags as Vice President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner announced the result. She cried legal abortion in the hospital as the measure passed. Argentina, until now, has punished women and those who help them end pregnancies. The only exceptions were cases involving rape or a risk to the health of the mother, but those were denied in some parts of the country. Before the vote, the Roman Catholic Bishops' Conference had denounced the measure as an obsession. Just hours before the Senate debate began Tuesday, the Pope tweeted, "The Son of God was born an outcast, in order to tell us that every outcast is a child of God." Following the vote, the bishops released a statement saying the measure will deepen even further the divisions in our country. It said the country's leadership was distant from the anti-abortion sentiment across the nation. Before the vote, the Catholic Church had joined forces with evangelical Christians in the country in an effort to defeat the measure. The Catholic Church in Argentina has great sway. There's a very strong Catholic culture in the political world, sociologist Fortunato Malamachi told the French news agency. He wrote a book about religion and Argentina. Argentine lawmakers rejected an earlier abortion bill in 2018. This time it was supported by the government. I'm Susan Shand.
The new movie, Wonder Woman 1984, has enjoyed a successful opening in 2020. The second movie in the Wonder Woman series reportedly earned $16.7 million over the Christmas weekend. That is not a large amount in a normal year. But the coronavirus health crisis has changed expectations in the movie business. Usually, movie theaters are filled throughout the winter holiday season in the United States. There are lots of releases and lots of people paying to see them. On Christmas Day alone in 2019, Star Wars: Rise of Skywalker earned $32 million from filmgoers. The media market research company Comscore reports that only 35% of North American movie theaters are even operating right now. Wonder Woman 1984 played in about 2,150 theaters. Media company HBO Max released it online at the same time. The movie made an additional $19.4 million internationally after opening a week earlier. To date, Wonder Woman 1984 has made about $85 million around the world. This is a very weak theatrical opening, said David Gross of Franchise Re, another market research company. Early foreign openings have been weak as well. Patty Jenkins directed and Gal Gadot starred in both films in the series. The first was a huge success, opening with more than $100 million in sales at 4,100 theaters. It set a record for biggest opening by a female filmmaker. It earned $822 million worldwide. Wonder Woman 1984 cost about $200 million to make. Before COVID-19 appeared, the film had been expected to earn about $1 billion from movie theater attendance. Franchise Re predicts that total earnings will be around $180 million. Warner Media owns the film series. It is counting on Wonder Woman 1984 to matter more to HBO Max, a movie service. There were some reports of technical problems, however, from fans trying to watch online. But Warner Brothers Studio is praising the performance as the best that could be expected, given the current conditions. The studio on Sunday announced that it would speed production of a third Wonder Woman film, with Jenkins and Gadot returning. Wonder Woman 1984 broke records and exceeded our expectations, said Andy Forsell, a Warner Media official. During these very difficult times, it was nice to give families the option of enjoying this uplifting film at home, he added. I'm Katie Weaver.
The COVID-19 pandemic affected many industries across the world in 2020. Many companies faced severe economic difficulties related to the worldwide spread of the new coronavirus. But some were able to develop new technologies to help fight the disease in an effort to improve people's lives. One of the first companies we reported on related to the pandemic developed a 3D printer to quickly produce oxygen valves to treat COVID-19 patients. The new Italian company, Isonova, found a way to use its 3D printing equipment to copy the medical devices. Valves are used to connect oxygen to patients suffering from breathing problems. The company produced the life-saving equipment for free after it learned many Italian hospitals faced a serious shortage of valves. The Code the Curve hackathon for young people led to several possible new ways to deal with COVID-19, the disease caused by the new coronavirus. The event's organizers included the United Nations, American technology company IBM, and European software business SAP. One of the winning teams created a system that uses machine learning and picture technology to examine chest x-rays to identify the most severe COVID-19 patients. Another team developed an app that uses virtual reality to let users explore different places around the world while exercising from home. Several companies studied the effectiveness of wearable devices to identify early signs of COVID-19. Researchers at America's West Virginia University reported in May a device they tested was able to identify COVID-19 signs up to 3 days before people started to experience them. Another research project carried out by the California-based Scripps Research Institute examined data from devices worn by more than 30,000 volunteers. Researchers said their early results showed the devices could successfully identify people who had no signs of COVID-19 but were still infectious. A Japanese company created a smart mask that aims to improve communication for people wearing face coverings. Donut Robotics calls its invention the Sea Mask. It is meant to fit over other kinds of face masks commonly worn by the public. The mask is made of soft plastic material and contains a built-in microphone. When it is turned on, the mask uses Bluetooth technology to connect to a mobile device. An app then helps users perform several actions, including turning speech into written text, completing telephone calls, and making the user's voice louder. The device can also translate a person's voice from Japanese into 8 other languages. Researchers reported success with machine learning systems designed to identify COVID-19 cases by the sounds of a person's cough. Machine learning describes computer technology that improves itself through a process similar to human learning. One study by the Massachusetts Institute of Technology showed a high success rate in identifying COVID-19 in people who had no physical signs of the disease. A team at Pennsylvania's Carnegie Mellon University has used similar methods to develop a voice-based testing system for COVID-19. That system uses recordings of coughs as well as some vowel sounds and the alphabet to identify signatures of the disease. Apple and Google cooperated to launch a mobile phone tool to follow the contacts of people infected with coronavirus. The technology became the basis for apps developed by U.S. states and several nations to carry out contact tracing. The system operates with Bluetooth wireless technology, which permits devices near each other to exchange information and create a record. If a device user becomes infected with the virus and agrees to share that information, the record is used to inform other people that they also might have been infected. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The Spanish-American War took place in the late 1800s during the administration of President William McKinley. On December 10, 1898, the United States and Spain signed a treaty in Paris, officially ending the war between them. However, the fighting had stopped much earlier. Spain had made the first move toward peace after its forces surrendered at Santiago on the Cuban coast. A few weeks before that, the United States Navy had destroyed Spain's Atlantic fleet. The American naval victory ended any chance that Spain could win the war. Doug Johnson and Steve Ember continue the story of President William McKinley and the Spanish-American War.
Late in July, the French ambassador in Washington gave President William McKinley a message from the Spanish government. Spain asked what terms the United States would demand for peace. President McKinley sent an immediate answer. Spain, he said, must give up Cuba. It must also give to the United States the islands of Puerto Rico and Guam. And he said Spain must recognize the right of the United States to occupy Manila in the Philippines. The future of the Philippines, he said, would be decided during negotiations on a peace treaty.
McKinley's terms seemed severe to Spain, but Spain had no choice. It could not continue the war. So, 10 weeks after war broke out, Spain agreed to stop the fighting and accept the American terms. It signed a peace agreement in Washington on August 12th. A Spanish note protested sadly that the agreement took away the last memory of a glorious past. It expels us from the Western Hemisphere, which became peopled and civilized through the proud efforts of our fathers.
The two countries agreed to meet in Paris to negotiate details of a peace treaty. The talks opened October 1st. The two sides agreed quickly on the issue of Cuban independence and an American takeover of Puerto Rico and Guam. But they could not agree on what to do about the Philippines. At the beginning of the talks, the United States was not sure if it wanted all or only part of the Philippines. At first, President McKinley wanted Spain to give up only Luzon, the main island. Then he decided that the United States should demand all of the Philippines. McKinley explained later how he made this decision.
I thought first we would take only Manila, then Luzon, then other islands, perhaps. I walked the floor of the White House many nights. More than once I went down on my knees and asked God to help me decide. And one night, said McKinley, it came to me this way, that we could not give the Philippines back to Spain. That would be cowardly and dishonorable. We could not turn them over to France or Germany, our trading competitors in Asia. That would be bad business. We could not leave them to themselves. They were not ready for self-government. So there was nothing for us to do but to take them all, and to educate the Filipinos, to civilize them, and make Christians of them. With that decision, said McKinley, I went to bed and slept well.
Spain, however, did not want to give up the Philippines. It protested that the United States had no right to demand the islands. True, Americans occupied Manila, but they did not control any other part of the Philippines. The two sides negotiated for days. Finally, they reached an agreement. Spain would give all of the Philippines to the United States. In return, the United States would pay Spain $20 million. With this dispute ended, the peace treaty was quickly completed and signed. But trouble developed when President McKinley sent the treaty to the United States Senate for approval.
Many Americans opposed the treaty. They thought McKinley was wrong to take the Philippines. Opponents of the treaty included former President Cleveland, industrialist Andrew Carnegie, labor leader Samuel Gompers, writer Mark Twain, and others. They organized anti-imperialist groups in many cities to oppose the treaty. They made speeches and published newspapers explaining their opposition. Imperialism, they said, had ruined ancient Rome, and it would ruin the American Republic. They said colonies halfway around the world would be costly to protect. A large army and navy would be needed. They said colonial policies violated important democratic ideas upon which the United States had been built. We went to war with Spain, they said, to free Cuba from its colonial masters, not to make ourselves masters of the Philippines.
Republican Henry Cabot Lodge of Massachusetts led the Senate fight for the treaty. The opposition was led by the other Massachusetts senator, George Hoar, also a Republican. Senator Lodge appealed to national pride. he urged the Senate not to pull down the American flag. Rejection of the treaty, he said, would dishonor the president and the country. It would show that we are not ready as a nation to enter into great questions of foreign policy. Senator Albert Beveridge of Ohio also spoke in support of the treaty. Senator Beveridge said the Pacific would be of great importance in coming years. Therefore, he said, the power that rules the Pacific will be the power that rules the world. And with the Philippines, that power is and forever will be the United States.
Senator Hoar spoke strongly against the treaty. He said that taking over the Philippines would be a dangerous break with America's past. He said the greatest thing the United States had was its tradition of freedom. To take the Philippines, he said, would deny that tradition. It would violate the Constitution and the ideas contained in the Declaration of Independence, the idea that all men are created equal, and that government exists only with the permission of the governed.
The Senate vote on the treaty was set for February 6th. It seemed that the opposition had enough votes to reject it. But several things happened before the vote. William Jennings Bryan, the leader of the Democratic Party, opposed the takeover of the Philippines. But he urged Democratic senators to vote for the treaty. Bryan was looking ahead to the presidential election in 1900. He believed that the Philippines takeover would cause the United States nothing but trouble. He could put the blame for all the trouble on the Republicans. Then, if he was elected president, the Democrats could give the Philippines their independence. Bryan succeeded in getting 17 Democrats and populists in the Senate to vote for the treaty.
2 days before the vote was taken, violence broke out in the Philippines. President McKinley, without waiting for the Senate to act, ordered the American military government in Manila to extend its control throughout the Philippines. The leader of the Philippine rebels, Emilio Aquinaldo, opposed the order. Rebel forces prepared to fight. On the night of February 4th, 30,000 rebels attacked American forces around Manila. 60 Americans were killed, and more than 270 were wounded. Rebel losses were much higher.
News of the rebel attack caused some senators to change their minds about the Philippines. Some who had opposed the treaty now agreed with the Washington Star newspaper that the Filipinos must be taught to obey. 84 senators were present for the vote on the treaty. To pass, the treaty needed a two-thirds majority, 56 votes. One by one, the senators voted. Then the count was announced. 57 of the lawmakers had voted yes. Only 27 had voted no. The treaty was approved. The Philippines belonged to the United States.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.